Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting the Senate Transportation Committee to order at 1:37 p.m. We're in Butchovich, Room 205 in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Thursday, February 27th, 2025. Members present are Senator Tobin, Senator Schauer, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Senators Stedman and Keel are up in Senate Finance. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I would like to extend a warm Senate Transportation welcome to our recording secretary, Heather Ramseth, and our LAO moderator, Doug Bridges. Welcome everyone to Senate Transportation. We have one item on our agenda today, and that is to hear from the Metropolitan Planning Organizations for Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Mat-Su Borough. All three presenters will provide an overview of their individual MPOs, and they have coordinated to each take a piece of discussing MPOs in general. Kim Solian from the Mat-Su will speak to the history of the creation of MPOs in federal legislation and the responsibilities of MPOs, once again, that's Metropolitan Planning Organizations, in the transportation planning process. Jackson Fox from Fairbanks will cover long and short-range transportation plans and TIP and STIP development and coordination. Aaron Jungelian will discuss recent FHWA, DOT, and MPO peer exchange with staff from the transportation agencies in Minnesota and North Dakota, and the 3C policy and procedure DOT is working on in collaboration with Alaska's three MPOs. On behalf of committee members, thank you for taking the time to coordinate your presentations so that we can cover all of the information that we have time for today. First up is Ms. Solian. Will you please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation?
Yes, thank you. Excuse me. My name is Kim Solian, and I'm the executive director for the MPO and Mat-Su, Mat-Su Valley Planning for Transportation, or MVP, as we like to call ourselves, because our name is a tongue twister. So thanks for having me today, and I'm just going to go through a few slides, overviewed, that I'm going to do the overview of MPOs, talk a little bit about Mat-Su and our newest MPO of the three in the state of Alaska, and then just touch a little bit on our involvement with the STIP development process. So to kick things off, I'll just have you turn to the next slide. So a little bit about the history of MPOs. So our origin extends from, we were birthed out of the 1950s Eisenhower Interstate System Development. And during that time, during the Federal Highways Act of 1965, it was the largest public works project in history, aimed at constructing 41 miles of interstate across the country through, I think it was, 42 state capitals across the country. And so the Federal Highway Administration gave large grants to states to construct portions of the highway system through their state. And through that process, the states went about, you know, designing and outlining where they're going to put their segment of interstate to hook up with their neighboring states, and started to build sections of that system. Unfortunately, there wasn't great coordination and collaboration with the local municipalities, the local cities, the local towns, and a lot of cities end up being devastated by the construction of the portion of interstate that ran through their city. And by historical records, over 1 million people were displaced through that process, and over 475,000 houses were level to add the interstate system. So cities and counties started to file lawsuits to stop construction of the interstate through their city, to have a different process to figure out where this piece of infrastructure should go. That's definitely, and they would have agreed, of benefit for the nation and their community, but they wanted to be involved in the process of where the new road would go. So next slide, please. In 1962, President Kennedy signed the Federal Highway Act, that required that urban areas that had a population of 50,000 or more needed to follow a continuous, cooperative, and comprehensive transportation planning process, which is the 3C processes we like to follow, call it, in order to for a state to receive federal funding to build infrastructure. They needed to follow this process, which included working with the local municipalities to plan together and to come to consensus on how grant funds were going to be spent to build infrastructure in those communities. So they really were benefiting the community in which the infrastructure was running through. And that really was the birth of the MPOs as we know today. There's about 459 MPOs across the country. There are small MPOs, under 200,000, and large MPOs, over 200,000. But essentially what we are these interjurisdictional organizations that have the responsibility to long-range plan for our region about where we want our future infrastructure to be. And that includes both, you know, roads on the national highway system, but also state roads, local roads, borough roads, city roads. So really responsible for doing all the long-range planning and then programming those funds. Next slide, please. So also in Federal Code Title 23, it outlines the work of the MPO, how an MPO needs to be formed, who needs to be involved. It does outline that we're responsible for creating five major plans as part of the work of our organization. And like I mentioned on the slide before, following the 3C cooperative, comprehensive, and continuous planning process, we need to develop a long-range plan, which is the Metropolitan Transportation Plan. All MPOs have to create them. There are a plan that looks at a 20-year horizon and outlines where all the different infrastructure needs to be, and that includes transit, bike and pedestrian, roads, as well as freight infrastructure. And with that, it's looking at both state, again, and local regional roads, and it outlines all those projects. And then the additional plan that follows that is our Transportation Improvement Plan, which is a four-year plan that programs the projects into a funding matrix that's fiscally constrained. And then we have a work plan for our organization staff that outlines how we're going to manage all of these planning projects and manage our TIP and manage the funding that's coming into our metropolitan planning area. And then a public participation plan, because the history of MPOs is about making sure that communities have the information they need, have the access to participate in the planning process for new infrastructure. We have a really robust public planning process to make sure we're reaching out to everyone. And then we have a Title VI plan that ensures that priority populations have access to our planning process and the information that we're providing. And then if we make a misstep, there's a procedure that folks can follow to ensure that we are connecting with all members of the community.
Thank you, ma'am. One moment. Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate this overview, as it's very helpful to understand why certain communities have MPOs and other communities in Alaska do not have them. I have a question about the work of the MPO that is outlined on this slide. And just curious how this may integrate with state transportation planning. What is the interaction between potential state projects that run through MPOs? How are those navigated and discussed, and who has responsibility for those, and who is the one engaged primarily in not only that planning, but also that public communication process and that public engagement process?
I take a deep breath on that, because I have training wheels on. I'm the newbie at the table. And so my colleagues, Aaron Jung and Aylin and Jackson Fox, can save me if I don't get it quite right. But so how I understand the interaction is that, so we, and on a future slide, I'll show you our metropolitan planning area boundary. And so we are responsible as the MPO to plan for infrastructure within our boundary. And on our policy board, the state of Alaska, the Mat-Su Borough, the city of Palmer and Wasilla, and the two tribes, Chicoloon Native Village and Kinnick Tribe, all sit on our policy board. And so as we're working through our Metropolitan Transportation Plan, They represent their constituents, and they will be ensuring that the priority projects that are either for the state, the borough, the cities, or the tribes, we're talking about them within our planning process, and that those projects that are a priority are going to make it into our Metropolitan Transportation Plan and then end up in our TIP. And so in theory, the state, the borough, the city, we're all at the table together, planning together, coming to consensus together on what the priority projects are in our region, and then they get programmed. The borough will have, you know, for, just to speak of the borough, like they are much larger, their jurisdiction is much larger than our metropolitan planning area boundary. So they'll have additional plans outside our MPO boundary, and we'll still coordinate across those boundaries. But so they'll have an additional plan that accompanies our metropolitan planning area boundary and our metropolitan transportation plan. So, excuse me, in theory, all of the projects in the region will show up in our plan within our boundary.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you. That's helpful. And so it sounds like you have a really robust representation on your MPO. And I'm assuming that everyone gets kind of one vote. But could you explain a little bit about how that the representation from these different groups engage? Is it that the tribes can say no to certain projects, or potentially the borough can say no to certain projects, or the state? Or is it really kind of just a democratic process in which every person who sits on that committee gets a vote?
So our policy board is a 7-member policy board. So we have one representative from Alaska DOT, the central region director, the mayor of Wasilla, the mayor of Palmer, the mayor of the borough, the manager of the borough, and the two tribal transportation reps from Chicoloon and Kinnick. And so the borough advocated for 2 seats on the policy board because they have the majority of the roads within the metropolitan planning area. So to answer your question about could the tribe say no to a project, or could the borough say no to a project? So we are going to follow a robust process to identify all the infrastructure needs that will put program into our metropolitan transportation plan. We will have community input, and then we will have input from the bodies that our policy board members represent. And it is possible that a project will show up that will be controversial, and a member will not want to have it in our metropolitan transportation plan. And as a policy board, they would talk it out together and vote on whether or not to have that project in the metropolitan transportation plan. So essentially, and Aaron and Jackson, jump in if you want to add to this, yes, our policy board could vote not to have a project within the Metropolitan Transportation Plan, because, you know, we're a body that's formed to do the long range planning for our region. So theoretically, we are coming to consensus, or they are coming to consensus as a body, about what infrastructure makes sense. And sometimes, you know, the city of Palmer might have a crazy idea to have a tunnel under Palmer-Wasilla Highway, and people might not want that, and it would be voted down. So, yes, that could happen.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Although I feel like tunnels seem to be a new popular thing that I keep hearing more and more about.
Probably not the best example, but yes.
Thank you, ma'am. Please continue.
Excuse me. I am getting over the crud that most of us have. If we could move to slide 5. So as I said, we're the newest MPO in Alaska. And on once the 2020 census was certified, the Mat-Su borough was designated as having an urbanized area. And so the title of our urban area was the Wasilla, Kinnick, Fairview, North Lakes urban area. And our title designation came out first, and then we received the map. But Palmer was pretty confused about why their name wasn't in the title, and we were too. But they were included once we finally saw the map that outlined that population. And so, like I said before, all urban areas that have a population density of over 50,000 people get this designation, and then there is a requirement to form a metropolitan planning organization after that happens. Next slide. And so here's a map from the census that outlines what our urbanized area looks like. There's about 57,000 people in our urban area. And what that means is that how the census calculates it is there is about 1,000 people per square mile, or 385 dwelling units per square mile. That equals that more than 1,000 people per square mile in a contiguous area over 50,000. And so that's kind of how the math works to figure out how a new urban area is designated. Next slide. So as I mentioned, the federal regulations require that once an urban area is designated, there is a requirement to form a metropolitan planning organization to be responsible for the long-range transportation planning of that area within 1 year of that census designation. And the reason it's a tight timeline, it gives you 1 year, is that in order to be eligible for federal funding, once you receive that urbanized area designation, you have to have an MPO that's taking responsibility for the planning and projects moving forward. So our MPO was designated or became official on December 19th, 2023. And so fortunately, we kind of saw as a community the writing on the wall that we were going to probably receive the designation, and the Alaska DOT since 2019, I believe, had given the Mat-Su Borough a number of planning grants to help coordinate the tribes, the cities, and the DOT to have the conversations about this future organization that we were likely going to have to create, to kind of set the stage of, well, what kind of organization do we want to be? And, you know, what do we want our policy board to look like? And what do we want our organizational structure to look like? So we were very fortunate that we were able to meet that 1 year deadline, because that would have caused a funding challenge had we not been able to do that. Next slide, please. So as I reviewed before, we have a 7-member policy board. There's representatives from each of the regional governments on our policy board, and the Mat-Su Borough has 2 reps, and so they have 2 votes. We also have a technical committee, a 16-member technical committee that has representatives from each of the regional governments, either planning directors, public works directors, and then we have other nonprofit advocates that are on our technical committee that represent trucking, transit, and bike and pedestrian facilities. I think one of the things I want to share about that is the work of the MPO, like I said, is planning. A lot of the heavy lifting happens at the technical committee level in terms of creating the planning projects and identifying the projects, and then it's brought to the policy board for final approval. Another thing to share is that there are, like I said, over 400 MPOs across the country, and their organizational structure is open. And so when we were talking about how we were going to form as an organization, it was the option that we could be housed at one of the regional governments, and that they would support our the organization of staff and infrastructure. And our Mat-Su Borough and the cities and the tribes decided none of them had the capacity to house our MPO, and they wanted it to be an independent nonprofit, so it had autonomy. And that when our policy board representatives showed up to the MPO meeting, they put their MPO hat on, knowing they were still representing, you know, their different regional government. And so we are now a nonprofit organization. Next slide. So another positive thing that the federal government did is decide that, okay, we are going to require these nonprofits or these MPOs to be formed once the region reaches a threshold of over $50,000 to be responsible for the long-range planning. We're going to also provide some funding to support the staff and the organization so that it can do the planning work, because it would have caused a heavy burden for small communities to also stand up this new organization and fund this new organization to do the planning part. So we do get federal funding both to manage the organization based on formula, and then we do get federal funding based on formula to for some of the infrastructure projects, and it's all based on population. So next slide. So as I mentioned before, we have a planning area boundary. It is in one of the federal requirements that the MPO, it's one of the first things the MPO does as part of its formation process, is to, the requirement is that we look at the urbanized area boundary and then do an exercise to project where we think the population is going to grow and what area is going to become urbanized over the next 20 years. And so then that is the boundary, the planning area boundary that we use to anchor our long range plans on. And so we went through an exercise to look at all the up and coming neighborhoods in the MATSU. We looked at current platting actions. We looked at large parcels and small parcels and talked to realtors and talked to developers to find out where things, they thought things were happening in the future. And then that's how we drew our planning area boundary. Every 10 years, we'll have the option to review our boundary to make sure we got it right with the certification of the next census. I assume our urban area boundary will change a little bit. Even if we don't change our metropolitan area boundary that much, maybe we don't grow as much as we thought we did, we have to make sure that our boundary includes the whole urbanized area boundary. So just some stats, we have about 73,000 people live within our urban area boundary, and it's about 120 square miles. Next slide.
Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on the boundary, you said that every 10 years you can review this, and can you walk a little bit through that process? Is it something that your MPO will initiate if you want to redraw your boundaries, or is that something that is mandated that you have to redraw them? How exactly does that process work, or do you know? I understand that you're new, so I can ask someone else that question too.
Thank you for that question. So my understanding is that because our metropolitan planning area boundary has to encompass the entire urban area boundary, and that boundary we receive from the census, so we'll be watching to see if the new urban area boundary changes and then goes outside of our metropolitan planning area boundary. So we would have to make that adjustment. But it's possible that, you know, if an Amazon call center got located in Meadow Lakes, our population is going to grow in that direction in a way that we didn't think it would. And so we might need to redraw our boundary based on development. So at that time, once we get the census designation and their assessment of our boundary, we'll have the opportunity to redraw our boundary and relook at how our population grow to make sure that we are still being responsive to that 20-year horizon where we thought the population was going to grow in the next 20 years.
Thank you, Senator Tobin. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'll look at this. You have it referenced here, the exact federal code. And so I'll also look at that because I'm very interested in this part. Thank you.
Great. Next slide. So just a little bit about where we are in our MPO's evolution. Within the last year, we have filed our articles of incorporation and our bylaws for nonprofit status with the state of Alaska. We have submitted and received our nonprofit 501c3 certification from the IRS. We've drafted and adopted all of our organizational and personnel policies. We've hired an executive director. We've opened a bank account. And we are just about to launch our first MTP, where the state of Alaska DOT is doing the final negotiations with a contractor that has been selected to work with us to work on our long-range, our metropolitan transportation plan. And I have advertised to hire staff, and I have interviews next week, so that's very exciting. So that's kind of where we are as an organization. That'll be our big push over the next year and a half to get our MTP completed, to get our TIP completed, and to be ready for fiscal year 27 funding. Next slide. So to wrap up, part of the invitation for us to come talk about the history of MPOs and our relationship with the state of Alaska and our connection on the STIP. So MVP is different than the other two MPOs because we don't have a metropolitan transportation plan and because we don't have a TIP yet, our engagement with the STIP is a little bit different. And so though we are an official MPO, we are eligible to receive our funding. So in October 1st of 2024, our sub-allocation of about $10 million was available to us, but we didn't have the mechanism to program those funds because we hadn't gone through our planning process. So Federal Highways suggested that we create something called a program of projects, which essentially meant that we looked at all the projects that are in the STIP that are within our metropolitan planning area boundary, and the policy board voted to allocate some of our funds to some of the projects that were already in the works. And so that's kind of how we're connected to the STIP right now. So through the STIP development process, we were given our sub-allocations. That's how much money we knew we expected to be coming towards us that we could program in our program of projects, and submitted that to the state with our formal board action so that they had it to include as they were finalizing the STIP. Once the STIP came out, there were a couple errors, and so we did submit letters to the state about that, letting them know that, yeah, there are just some calculation errors related to the allocations that we were told we were going to have and what we programmed. And with the amendment, there were still a couple other errors, and we let the, you know, DOT know of those errors, and then we're still, the STIP amendment number 2 is just out. So we are just reviewing those numbers at this point. But we are, again, in a little bit different place because we don't have an MTP or a TIP. And we are just hoping that the state will you know, DOT will follow what our policy board asked in terms of having our funds allocated in a certain, towards a certain project. So that is all I have for my presentation, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk a little bit about the history of MPOs and to share a little bit about MVP and our evolution as a new metropolitan planning organization in MATSU.
Senator Schauer has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I get a lot of questions from constituents in the Valley that would be concerned that one of the reasons they moved to the Valley so is they had more property, they had more personal freedoms. We were ironically talking about this just before the committee hearing started. And how would the MPO address the questions and concerns that constituents in the Valley have about how this urban planning might come in with things like sidewalks and bike paths and other things that may impede on their ability to essentially do what they want to do with their land? Or neighborhoods might. So, Mr. Chairman, that's a pretty broad question. So please don't take 5 minutes to answer it. I'm just kind of curious, as the board discussed, how they would address citizens' concerns about the becoming like a 15-minute city. I get those questions, so I'm just wondering. Thank you.
Thank you for that question. And I think my answer is that the MPO doesn't we are not responsible for land use planning regulations. Those regulations sit with the cities and the borough. And so the cities and the borough, you know, would be requiring, if you were going to put streetlights and sidewalks in neighborhoods, that would be on their jurisdiction. But for the MPO, what the benefit of having an MPO and living within the boundary of an MPO is that now there's local control over those federal dollars. Now someone that represents you as a citizen is on a policy board having a say on where federal dollars are being spent in your community versus having, before we had an MPO, the state may spend federal dollars wherever they want, wherever the state sees as a priority. But now the cities, the borough and the tribes and the state all decide together what the priority is. And hopefully that means better benefits to the citizens, that the citizens are actually getting the infrastructure that they want versus what a higher level of government is choosing.
Thank you. Ms. Solian, I have a couple of questions. I'm just wondering, key takeaways that the public might be able to learn from this presentation. Do you believe that MPOs are incentivized to advocate against projects in other areas so that their area can be eligible for more dollars?
Again, I have training wheels on, but our funding comes to our region based on formula. And so it's formula driven. And so I can't speak to saying no to a project somewhere else so that we could get more funding in our area. I think there's a set amount of funding that's coming to our area based on our population. And that's what gets divvied up for projects that the policy board thinks is the priority.
Thanks,
and maybe Jackson and Aaron can help. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for that answer. Is it your understanding of an MPO that they are available for additional funds that folks outside of an MPO are not eligible for?
I'm not sure how to answer that. As a MPO, and now that MVP is a nonprofit, we are eligible to apply for federal grants that maybe the city or the local borough government isn't eligible for. So if that's what you mean, additional funds, we can apply for additional grant funds that could be utilized to support infrastructure. I'm sorry if I missed the question, but.
Let me simplify it for you. If it is true that because an area has an MPO that they do qualify for additional road funds, would it make sense that the state prioritize capital funds related to roads differently based on the presence of an MPO in an area versus a part of a state where there is not an MPO?
I don't think because we have an MPO, we are getting additional funds. I think that the state of Alaska receives its allocation of federal funds, and because our population is growing and now we are an urban area, some of the funding that the state receives comes to our area because we are experiencing such population growth. We have issues with congestion and safety and connectivity, and so focusing some additional funds on the area because of that to support commerce and getting people to school and work is needed in the area. So I don't think it's additional. We're not getting additional funds. I'm sorry, I'm still feeling like I'm not answering your question, but maybe Aaron or Jackson can add to that.
That's an answer. Thank you, ma'am. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Next up, we have Jackson Fox from the Fairbanks. Excuse me. Oh, FAST, Fairbanks Area Surface Transportation Planning Group. Mr. Fox, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Yeah, thank you. This is Jackson Fox. I'm the Executive Director of FAST Planning up in Fairbanks. Just a little bit of background on me before I start the presentation. I did grow up down in Anchorage. And moved up to Fairbanks in 1999 for college at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I'm a graduate of UAF. I did spend a few years working in engineering consulting, and then 11 years at the City of Fairbanks in their engineering department. And here more recently, for the past 7 years, I've been the director of the MPO up here, serving Fairbanks and North Pole. So next slide. For my presentation here today, I think Kim did a wonderful job of explaining to you all what MPOs are and what we do, so I'm not going to get into that in a whole lot of detail other than give you an introduction to our MPO and how we are formed and the local governments that we work with and who serves on our policy board and in our committees. I'll also share with you our metropolitan planning and area boundary, similar to the map that Kim showed to you all for the Mat-Su region. But my focus at the end of the presentation is to dive into our required transportation plans and the relationship between our long range or 20-year transportation plan, which we call our MTP or Metropolitan Transportation Plan, and how that feeds into our short range funding plan, which is our TIP, and then how the TIP feeds into the statewide funding plan, which is the STIP. And then I'm going to talk briefly about the recent STIP amendments and coordination with the MPOs, coordination with the state on our TIP and our coordination with them on the STIP. Okay, next slide. So at FAST Planning, we're a small office. Kim's office will be pretty small as well, but we just have four staff members. Of course, I'm the executive director of the organization. I do have two full-time transportation planners, Olivia and Corey on the screen there. And then Deborah Todd, who's been with the organization the longest, she is our part-time admin, and she does all of our accounting here. But she's been a very valuable resource for us because she spent 31 years at the state DOT up here in Fairbanks, retired, and is continuing to work for the MPO after that. Okay, next slide. For our organization, we were formed just over 20 years ago following the results of the 2000 census. We opened up our doors in 2003. Our urbanized area population is about 70,000 people that we serve, which is about 10% of the state's population. And we are also operated currently as a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We moved to an independent agency back in 2019, shortly after I took this position. But our core responsibilities are to carry out that transportation planning process in coordination with the federal law and federal regulations, to develop our region's long and short-range transportation plans. And as part of that process, empowering our local governments in that decision-making process for our planning efforts and the projects that we select within our boundary. And along the way, continuously engaging the public in that transportation planning process and project selection process.
Senator Tobin has a question.
I apologize, Jackson, or excuse me, Mr. Fox. I have a quick question around your boundary area. As I see here that you were formed in 2003 following the 2000 census, and so I'm assuming that in the census since then that you've gone through some boundary redraws or potentially have had the opportunity to, and so I'm curious about the boundary line that you must have drawn off of the 2020 census and if that had changed your area.
Yes, as a result of the 2020 census, we have expanded our metropolitan planning area due to population growth and in specific, a lot of new neighborhoods and subdivisions in the North Pole area that have come up over the past 5 to 6 years in coordination with the growth at Eielson Air Force Base. So our new proposed boundary from the 2020 census now includes the main installation at Eielson Air Force Base, a neighboring community called Moose Creek. And then to the north of us, there's been some additional housing development off Farmers Loop Road, which our area expanded to as well. So, however, that boundary has not yet been approved by the governor's office. So we are still operating underneath our 2013 boundary, which resulted from the 2010 census, until we get a governor's signature.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. And that I find that interesting, where in 2025, is this typical for it to take 5 years after a census to approve an update to the boundary line?
No, we've not experienced this in the past, but we've only been through a couple of boundary updates since they're only done once every 10 years. But I've not seen this delay either with other MPOs in the lower 48.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. That's interesting, and I'll definitely follow up as I know that I'm very curious about that.
Okay, next slide. As an MPO, we operate underneath an intergovernmental operating agreement. This is an agreement that the MPO doesn't sign. This is an agreement between the state and our local governments to establish our MPO and identify the roles and responsibilities of the state and each of our local governments. So this is an agreement signed between the two cities up here, City of Fairbanks, City of North Pole, and the Fairbanks North Star Borough and the state. And the last time that we updated this was in 2019 when we migrated to an independent agency, which actually reduced some of the roles and responsibilities on the local governments since we have independent utility and are fully staffed off the payrolls of any of the local governments. Next slide. This is our metropolitan planning area boundary. It's actually a similar shape to the MATSU boundary. As Kim had explained to you all, it is based on a boundary provided to us by the U.S. Census Bureau, and then we expand that out to what we foresee to be urbanized 20 years from now. So this is from the 2013 boundary as a result of the 2010 census. But as you can see here, within our boundary, we have the full city limits of the City of Fairbanks and City of North Pole. We have the entire University of Alaska Fairbanks campus. And then in the middle of our boundary, we have the Fort Wainwright Army Base. The disclaimer with that is that we do not do any transportation planning work for military lands, nor are we allowed to spend our federal highway or federal transit funds on the military base. The expectation is that their plans and their projects on base are funded through Department of Defense funds. But we do have a seat for them at the table on our committees to participate in our planning process, specifically surrounding projects near the gates, you know, the entrances and exits to the base. So they are very helpful to have at the table. And recently here with our Metropolitan Boundary Area expansion, we opened up a new seat as well for Eielson Air Force Base to our southeast of the community. But as you can see in the lower map there in red, we are a very small portion of the entire Fairbanks Star Spar Borough. It really is just that urban core in which we serve. Okay, next slide. With regard to our board and our committee structure, our policy board, as there is a policy board for MATSU and a policy board for Anchorage, this is our primary decision-making body, and I'll get into it in future slides who makes up that board. But serving as advisory committees to that board, our primary advisory committee is what we call our technical committee, and I also have a slide on that membership. And then we have some supporting committees that advise our technical committee, including the Bicycle Pedestrian Committee, which is made up of citizens primarily as advocates for bicycles and pedestrians in our community. We also have a project enhancement committee that does reviews and provides suggestions on designs for the projects that we fund to advance up to the board. And then we also have a seasonal mobility task force, which is made up of all the area maintenance managers, which of course we rely heavily on their input for identification of transportation projects to spend our federal money on. As well as projects are designed, it's critical that we share those with our area maintenance managers, because whatever gets built, they are going to inherit and it's going to end up being their responsibility. So, again, we have a committee there to consider their needs as well. And all of our committee and board meetings are open to the public. And so just to kind of give you an idea, over the past year in 2024, amongst all these committees and the board, we had 48 open public meetings. So there's ample opportunity for the public to participate, provide comment, and influence our planning efforts and our project selection. Next slide. On our policy board, similar to MATSU, we have a 7-member board. There are 5 local government seats and 2 state seats. We have all 3 local mayors participating on our board for the City of Fairbanks, City of North Pole, and the Fairbanks North Star Borough. We have 2 additional seats, one for a Fairbanks City Council member and another one for a borough assembly member. And then our 2 states are filled by the DOT Northern Region Director and the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Air Quality Director. And that's an interesting seat for us up here because we are in a PM2.5 non-attainment area for air quality standards. And unfortunately, our federal highway funding is linked to our air quality problem up here. Not that emissions are a big contributor to our air quality problem, but being in non-attainment affects how much and what we can use our funding on up here. But again, it's 5 local government members and 2 state seats. And so when we get into discussions about controversial projects, this is where the local control comes from in the makeup of our board here. Next slide. And then our primary advisory body to that technical committee is a rather large committee. It's 18 members. As you can see here on the screen, we have 7 state seats on our technical committee. We have 3 city seats. We have 4 borough seats. And then we also, as I mentioned before, we have seats for the Fort Wainwright Army Base and the Eielson Air Force Base, as well as a couple seats for a freight representative and a tribal representative. But these, all of the individuals that fill these seats here are primarily department heads or senior level staff at each of these agencies and within their departments, where part of their job focuses on transportation, you know, whether that be roads or rail or transit or, you know, design and construction of transportation projects. So Anyways, this is a very inclusive committee, and they, again, this is the primary body that provides recommendations up to our board for decisions. Okay, next slide. So that's kind of who we are and what we do and what our makeup is and how and who we work with. I'm diving in now to our primary required transportation plans, which is our MTP and TIP. So on the left there is our 20-year long-range transportation plan, which feeds into our short-range funding plan or our TIP. I'm going to give you kind of a preview into what our long-range plan looks like, but it is identifying every transportation project that we need on our network over a 20-year horizon. So this is not a general document. It's very specific. It's performance-based, and it's based on the transportation needs that we see on the ground here in identifying project lists for 0 to 5 years out, 5 to 10 years out, and 10 to 20 years out. And then we take the short-range list from that long-range plan, and we feed that into our short-range 4-year funding plan or our TIP. Next slide. So taking a look into our long-range plan, kind of as I described, this is the main project map within that plan, which highlights our transportation network, everything from local roads to collector roads to arterial roads, our highway system, and it identifies all the planned improvements to those roadways, again, over that 20-year horizon. And they're color-coded based on whether they're needed to be constructed in the short range, medium range, and long range in the years I described. Next slide. And then behind those project maps that we have in our long range plan is the actual list. So it's not just a dot on the map, but that has specific project titles and termini and specific project scopes for what is intended to be constructed. Next slide. And again, that short range list from our long-range plan feeds into our short-range funding plan or our TIP, as you can see here on the screen. So those short-range projects get advanced, and so you'll see the project title, the scope description, and then you'll see the funding that we've dedicated to those projects across all phases from design to right-of-way to utilities to construction. And this document it is really limited to all of the projects within our boundary that are receiving federal funding to move forward. So this is not a funding plan that we would necessarily show state funded projects in. It's primarily for just the federally funded projects. Next slide. And it is a conglomeration of all of our different project types. Our local MPO projects, which is the funding that is sub-allocated to our MPO for local road improvements, which is about $12.5 million a year, as well as our DOT highway projects, which that investment has typically been $35 to $40 million per year, and then any rail project and any transit project. This might be bus stops. This might be bus shelters. Recently here, we funded a project to install a compressed natural gas fueling station for our transit agency as they're converting their fleet from diesel to compressed natural gas projects of that type. And historically, year to year for construction up here in Fairbanks, we've seen about a $50 million total investment in transportation projects per construction season. But of course, last year and this year, that amount's been reduced to about $25 to $30 million due to some of the challenges with the STIP. Next slide.
Senator Tobin has a question.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fox. So you've indicated that the funding, because of the issues with the STIP, has been reduced. Are you anticipating that to rebound back to $50 million? Or going forward, are you thinking 25 to 30 is going to be the new norm?
Well, the hope is in 2026, it rebounds to closer to 50 to 60 million, and we have a more normal construction year. So but no, this summer I'm projecting 25 to 30 million based on the tentative advertising schedule for what I see might occur within our boundary. And I also wanted to note, this is not exclusively due to some of the challenges with the STIP, but with our air quality issues up here, we are in a conformity freeze. Because we're not meeting attainment of air quality standards, which means our funding plan is frozen and we cannot proceed with amendments to our funding plan. for projects that are not exempt from air quality conformity. So there are a few large highway projects in our boundary that have effectively been paused due to our air quality issues up here. So we have a couple compounding factors. And our hope is that the conformity freeze is lifted by December of this year. That's what we're hearing from the EPA. So hopefully 2026 will hopefully return to normal.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know this is a question for you to guesstimate, and I apologize for that, and please feel free to punt. But if you could estimate how much of your reduction in what you're seeing or what you anticipate for projects this summer is due to the air quality, would it be 10%, 30%, 50%? Just an idea to understand the intersection between what has happened with the STIP and this freeze, this conformity freeze.
I haven't run those numbers, but it could be around anywhere from 30 to 50% due to the conformity freeze. There were some big projects that were supposed to advance this year that are paused.
Thank you.
Okay, next slide. So kind of explaining the relationship between our long-range transportation plan, our short-range TIP, and the state's STIP. The entire transportation planning process for projects in our boundary starts with that long-range plan and those project lists in that long-range plan. So they must be first identified in that foundational document, that long-range plan. And then the short-range list from that long-range plan gets fed into our short-range TIP. And then that short-range TIP is supposed to be incorporated by reference into the STIP without change. So in any event, that's the process and how they all feed into each other. And the STIP is really the last step where our TIP is amended into the STIP by reference. Next slide. And now I want to talk a little bit about our TIP development and then coordination with the STIP. I'll kind of run through this briefly for you here. I do want to note first off that not all projects in our long-range plan, short-range list can be afforded to move forward. We may have, say, $60 million per year in projects in our long-range plan, but realistically, we might get, you know, say, $50 million of that actually into our plan. But what we do is that when we develop our TIP, we issue a call for project nominations to our local governments for projects that they want to sponsor. And when I say sponsor, I mean they need to commit to paying the 9% match on these projects and commit to maintaining them after they're constructed. And then for the state highway projects, we work closely with DOT planning and pre-construction staff on the highway projects that are included in our long-range plan. As long as they commit to funding those projects with statewide apportionments, then they do make it into our short-range plan. And then DOT is also critical. Their planning and pre-construction staff prepare all the scope, schedules, and estimates for these projects because they have the latest pulse on bid prices and design effort. They also manage the delivery of all of our projects, whether it's a locally sponsored project or it's a state highway project. They manage that design and construction project on everyone's behalf. Next slide. And so once we have all of these scope schedules and estimates and funding commitments and match commitments for these projects, they are then scored and prioritized by our technical committee and policy board for inclusion into our TIP. The preliminary draft of that is prepared by FAST Planning staff, primarily myself, and then we share out that preliminary draft with back to DOT planning and pre-construction and our federal partners for interagency review. Once that review is complete and any revisions requested are resolved, we re-present the official draft STIP to our technical committee and policy board to release it for a 30-day public comment period and then subsequent adoption after that. And then after it is adopted by our policy board, there's still a few approval steps. We advance that adopted document to the DOT Commissioner's Office for the Governor's approval, and then the authorizations from our federal partners to move forward with that funding plan.
Senator Tobin.
Next slide.
Senator Tobin, yes. Next question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fox. I feel like I'm taking up everyone's time, but I'm very curious. What happens if the governor does not approve the TIP?
Then any future years in the TIP, federal funding is frozen within our area. And this would, again, include all of the local projects as well as all of the highway projects. So it is in everyone's best interest to try to achieve consensus on this to get an approvable document moving forward.
I apologize, Mr. Fox. I'm thinking of a scenario that as you have your community technical and policy board who works diligently to hear the community concerns and needs, and yet you have one individual who could potentially derail all of that hard work. I'm curious of how is that happened before, or how do you navigate that?
I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you it's not happened before with our MPO up here. And I've not heard of an example where that's happened in the lower 48 at other MPOs. It's supposed to be a cooperative process. At times it could not be. So I could see this scenario playing out as you described, but I've not experienced that or been through that type of conflict resolution process.
Thank you. And my second question is one that I could also ask AMATS. It's the one I've engaged with the most, but because you have it listed on this slide, you indicate that projects are ranked and then prioritized. And I'm curious how are they ranked? What are the criteria that is used to create that prioritization list?
So we have evaluation criteria in our long-range plan. It's kind of a short subset of criteria. But when projects actually get nominated to us, we do have a two-page scoring form that crosses a lot of different categories from safety to state of good repair, preservation activities, serving projects that may serve schools or minority populations, et cetera. So we have a very long list of criteria that we actually assign numbers to with weighted categories, and that can be found on Fast Planning's website.
Thank you.
Okay, next slide. I think I only have two more slides left. So we can get to Aaron. For the STIP development, recent STIP amendments, I just want to first note that federal regulations do require the state to develop their STIP in coordination with the MPOs. But as you may have heard, this really hasn't historically occurred. And this coordination did not occur with the original STIP or STIP amendment number one or STIP amendment number two. And this is still an outstanding corrective action item for the STIP. From the Federal Highway Administration. So Aaron will speak to you later about the 3C policy and procedure that DOT is working on to outline roles and responsibilities for staff to improve this coordination. But we're not quite there yet with implementation of that coordination. So functionally, what's been happening is that we get to see the STIP or the STIP amendment once it's released for public comment. Staff do review that and prepare preliminary comments, but we have some back and forth with our technical committee and policy board, and really our opportunity to provide any input on that is through comment letters. And we did provide a comment letter in the original STIP amendment number one, and we are working right now on a comment letter for STIP amendment number two. So there is some room for improvement here, and we are working collaboratively with the state on kind of what our expectations might be with that. And we are having a standing quarterly meeting up here in Fairbanks where MATSU and Anchorage and DOT and our federal partners will all be up here at Fairbanks Monday and Tuesday to work through some of these issues to get us all to a better place. Next slide. But I did want to, give the Senate Transportation Committee a heads up about some of the uncertainties that have come out in the past 2 weeks at the federal level that may affect the timeline of approval of STIP Amendment Number 2. As I hope you are all aware, the Alaska Division Office of Federal Highways has lost 5 staff members this month, and so we're hearing from staff members there that the staff members that are left are covering more than one role, and so review times, documents that are passed to them may take longer. We also got an announcement on February 20th, so just 1 week ago, that there's a new added layer of review at the federal level for STIP amendments. So once a STIP amendment is turned into federal highways, it does have to go to Washington, D.C. for review by the Office of General Counsel before the State Division Office can approve that amendment. And the notice that we received from the National Association of MPOs, at least six states have experienced this delay so far, just in the last week in turning in amendments and them not getting turned around quickly because of this review. But I've not heard back yet on how long this new layered review will take in Washington, D.C. before it's turned back to the State Division Office. So just want you all to be aware that with STIP Amendment number 2, it could lead to an extended review period and disruption to project schedules, moving to trying to get stuff advanced to construction this summer. And that concludes my presentation. I appreciate all of your time.
Senator Schauer's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't think we need Andy up to ask this one. We've addressed it before, but I think, you know, we've heard concerns from general contractors. We see what's happened to the MPOs. There's a lot of activity that we're probably not going to get to, whether it's federal money and how it comes in tranches that sometimes is too late based on our construction season, the amount of workers we have available, the amount of contractors we get from out of state, a lot of projects here, and then we're adding issues with the federal government as a lot of things are shaking out. So I guess, Mr. Chairman, maybe a comment and not necessarily asking Andy to come up and address that, but back to those that are listening, I think we're at a place where we find ourselves, we don't really have everything we need to address all the concerns or projects that we have. So this just seems to be adding, Mr. Chair, to the comments we've had before, I think, and you've made a lot of them about whether or not we can even get there from here right now. So some daunting challenges for us at the state level. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Fox, for joining us today. I just have a couple of questions. Do you feel like a metropolitan planning organization is incentivized to advocate against projects in other areas of the state so that more funds would be available for projects inside of your metropolitan planning area?
No, I don't. Kind of reading between the lines, we did provide a comment on the Sterling Highway project, the Cooper Landing Bypass, back in September 2023. And as an MPO, we commented on that project because we saw the price tag escalate from $300 million up to over $900 million. And our concern at the time is that the state is only apportioned about $750 million per year, and this is a major project to get into, which could take away from projects all across the state. And along with that comment in that letter, we highlighted that the Mat-Su area was the fastest growing region of the state, and that that we were concerned that a project of that size could potentially take away from a more equitable distribution across the state. But our comment at that time was not aimed at getting any additional funds for our area. Just highlighting that concern for the general public to pay attention to.
As an MPO, do you all have access to funds that areas in the state do not have access to because they are not in a metropolitan planning organization?
Yes, we do. By formula, there are funds that are dedicated to urban areas, and there are funds that are dedicated to rural areas, and there's funds that are dedicated for statewide use. So yes, we do have access to the urban area funds. We do not have access to the rural funds, but in coordination with the state, we can access funds that are available for use statewide if DOT is interested in using those funds to invest in our area.
Thank you. Next up, we'll hear from Aaron Yonganalen. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Hello, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Great. Thank you. I am Aaron Yonganalen. I'm the executive director of AMATS. Okay, next slide, please. AMATS. So we are the Anchorage Metropolitan Area Transportation Solutions. We are the MPO that covers the area for Anchorage, Chugach, Eagle River, and the Native Village of Aklutna. So as you can see from our boundary there, it does cover the vast majority of the municipality of Anchorage, but we do not include the communities south of the Potter Marsh Way Station, so Indian, Bird, and Girdwood. We haven't included them in our boundary because population densities don't reach down that far, so typically aren't in there. I do want to note that this boundary map has been updated. As you've heard from Jackson, they had a boundary update, so did we. That boundary update has not been approved yet. One of the key changes with this boundary update is the removal of the Anchorage CO limited maintenance area. We were successful in getting that limited maintenance area completed, its second 10-year period completed. So we're very excited for that. That means we only have one limited maintenance area left in our area. Next slide, please. Okay, so how is AMATS a little different from the other MPOs? We are what's known as a TMA. So areas that are 200,000, greater than 200,000 are called a TMA, which is a transportation management area. And I'll talk a little bit more about this in the next slide or so. So AMATS is the only TMA in Alaska. And one thing to note with AMATS, we're different from MVP and FAST because we are housed as staff within the municipality of Anchorage as Muni staff, but we're funded by the federal program. And we report to the policy committee. So in my position, I have multiple bosses that I report to, but predominantly the policy committee that oversees AMATS. And I'll get into who the policy committee is here and shortly. Next slide, please. Okay, TMAs. What are the benefits? What are some drawbacks to it? So the biggest drawback to a TMA is we have additional oversight. I guess you could say drawback in quotes, is additional oversight that we have to deal with or additional planning efforts that we have to deal with. The first one is known as a congestion management process. Basically, it's a process that looks at our region and how to address and manage congestion, both reoccurring congestion, such as your average regular day commuting, and then non-reoccurring congestion, such as incidents or, incidents or accidents on like the highway or other things like that. This process is used to help kind of determine whether or not we should be moving forward with, say, a capacity project, such as a highway expansion, or we should be looking at other types of projects that are not capacity expansions, such as transit or, you know, working from home or other things like that. It's basically a way to help be like, do you need this really expensive project or can you do something a little bit cheaper, less impactful? We also have certification reviews that we have to go through, unlike the other MPOs. Every 4 years, the federal government, so Federal Highway Administration and Federal Transit Administration, come in, sit down with AMATS staff and DOT staff and review all of our documents, all of our processes, and make sure that we are complying with federal regulations. It's a pretty labor-intensive process, 2.5-3 days of going through this. And typically at the end, we get a report from the federal government on if we have any corrective actions, any recommendations or commendations. This last certification review was done in 2023. AMATS had 6 corrective actions, 14 recommendations, and 2 accommodations. It's not unusual to get corrective actions or recommendations from FHWA. It's really just a way to make sure that we're continuing to move forward, adhering to the federal processes. And if anything has slipped over the years, we need to, you know, address those as we go along. I am happy to say that we were able to address all 6 corrective actions, in part with DOT's help. DOT staff was very valuable in helping us address those corrective actions. Now, is there a benefit to being a TMA? And the answer is yes, in a way. We actually have access to more funding than the other MPOs. And that's because Alaska receives specific funding based on population allocation. So areas that are, 50,000 to 200,000 or greater than 200,000 or less than 50,000. As a TMA, we're in that greater than 200,000. We're the only one. So we get all of the money for that 200,000 or greater. And it's a pretty key distinction to remember here for that type of funding. That type of funding cannot be used out of the areas of 200,000 or greater. So for example, AMATS's funding can't be taken from AMATS and put somewhere else, like in the Matsu Borough or in the Fairbanks or outside of our boundary. Must be within the MPA boundary. That's why it's pretty critical to have good coordination between the different groups. Next slide, please. Okay. Policy committee. Who makes up our policy committee? They're our governing body, very similar to what the MATSU and FAST have. So we have 5 members. Our chair is the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities Commissioner, or their designee. In this case, it's the regional director. The central region director is the designee for the chair. We have the Municipality of Anchorage mayor, or their designee, as the vice chair. We have the Department of Environmental Conservation commissioner, or their designee, excuse me. And then we have two local assembly members. There's another person that is an alternate for the assembly members in case one is unable to make it to a meeting. Next slide, please. Our technical advisory committee. So very similar to the other MPOs, we have a group that takes a review of everything and uses their technical expertise to review it prior before submitting it to the policy committee. It's an 11-member committee. Municipality of Anchorage has a number of different departments like traffic and health and parks and rec on there, and then project management and engineering, and of course the planning department. Then we have the Alaska Railroad Corporation, the Don Young Port of Alaska. We have the Department of Transportation, the Anchorage Field Office, and then the pre-construction engineer. And then lastly, we have the Department of Environmental Conservation, air quality aspects. Next slide, please.
Senator Tobin has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Young-Nalen. I have a question just in comparison to FAST, which has tribal representation and representation from their military communities. How did the technical and, or excuse me, the policy and the technical and policy committee of AMATS get comprised? And has there ever been conversations around tribal representation and military representation?
So AMATS actually was designated first back in 1976. So we've been around for quite a while. Our last operating agreement was updated, I think, in 2003, or the last redesignation of it was 2003 or somewhere, where that determines what the makeup of the policy committee and the technical advisory committee is. So it's been around for a while. I believe there's been some discussion over the last little bit about should AMATS update its policy committee. The policy committee hasn't weighed in on that, and yes or no, so I'm not sure. JBEAR is actually involved in one of our subcommittees, our community advisory committee. It will be on the next slide. And then the Native Village of Kalutna, there's actually an agreement between the Municipality of Anchorage on behalf of AMATS and the Native Village of Kalutna on how we interact and work together. So we are required to do a lot of coordination with the Native Village of Kalutna for all of our documents that we put out, like the MTP and the TIP. So typically what we do is we go out to the Native Village of Kalutna, or we have a virtual meeting with them. We sit down and we walk through our documents. We get their feedback on how best to help them in their community.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Obviously, communities are different, and so it's curious to know how we incorporate these voices in different ways. Thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. Next slide, please. Okay, we have the AMATS subcommittees. As I mentioned, we have Community Advisory Committee. So this is an 11-member committee that's predominantly made up of representatives from the different assembly districts. We also have JBEAR on there. We have the Federation of Community Councils on there. This community, or this committee, is really about the community's voice as part of the process. We have the Freight Advisory Committee. So we have the Freight Group, the Port of Alaska, the Alaska Railroad on there. It's because we recognize that there are different voices for our different area, kind of as mentioned earlier, and how they have a piece of the pie, so to speak, or how they're involved is through these subcommittees. And then we have the Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Committee. I will note that all three of our subcommittees have been on a little bit of a hiatus. AMATS has been understaffed for a while, and so we are just now starting those committees back up, which we're very excited for. Next slide, please. Okay, AMAT staff. So typically there's five AMAT staff members. There's myself, director. Then we have a public involvement coordinator, Christine Schutte, and then Leifi Felice, who just joined us as an associate planner, our GIS tech. And we have two vacant positions. So we're hoping to get staffed up here soon. I will say that a lot of MPOs that are our size in the lower 48 typically have about 11 staff members and or including some lawyers on hand. So we are a little small in terms of our staff, but we're still able to get a lot of the work done. Next slide, please. Okay, enough about AMATS. So now how do the MPOs and DOTs coordinate, or DOT coordinates in our community? So I'm going to go through four different things here. I'm going to talk about the peer exchange that we recently had. I'm going to talk about the 3C process. And then I'll talk about coordination on STIP Amendment number 2. And then what is working well. Next slide, please.
Just a time check. We got about 10 minutes left in today's hearing.
Okay. I'll make it quick. Peer exchange. So we recently had a peer exchange where Department of Transportation invited up two other MPOs through the lower 48 and two other DOTs to sit down and talk about processes, how they do it as MPOs and DOTs in the lower 48. A lot of really good information learned that we can hopefully move forward on. There are about 10 to 12 action items developed. We had one of the key things learned was documentation of the process is crucial to ensuring that you have a good collaborative process and continuing communication and outreach every day. All that we always continuously communicate is essential. And making sure that all staff are part of the process. So it's not one person developing the STIP or the TIP. It's everybody working together on it. Next slide, please. 3C process documentation. So I provided you the documentation so you can read through it if you have any questions on there. This is a requirement of DOT to develop as part of their STIP corrective actions. It's basically a way to document how DOT coordinates with us as the MPOs on these crucial documents, such as the MTP and the TIP and the STIP. And so this is a really good first step for us to have something in writing so we can work on as we move forward. This was brought through the different MPOs for their comments. And a thing to note on this, it's a living document. So it's something that we're going to routinely update and revisit on a regular basis. Next slide, please. STIP Amendment number 2, I will note that at the policy committee last week, there was a concern brought up from a committee member that there was no coordination with AMATS on STIP Amendment number 2 prior to being released for public comment. I did verify, and you heard earlier from Jackson and also Kim, that they were not coordinated with fully on the STIP Amendment number 2. So although we have these good things like peer exchanges and the 3C document, we still have some more work on figuring out how best to coordinate with the MPOs. Next slide, please. And then what's working well? What do healthy relationships enable in our communities? We have very good coordination at the regional level, especially on projects and other things like that. We're constantly being involved in the project development process, which is really appreciated. Very good work on HSIP coordination. I think all communities have recently, MPO communities have recently experienced a little bit of an issue with HSIP projects just kind of appearing out of nowhere. So DOT has taken the step to reach out to the MPOs, sit down and do work sessions to go over the projects, go over the process, and to get nominations from the MPOs. So we're very excited for that and moving forward. And then lastly, specifically in the Anchorage area, a Vision Zero Task Force. We have a lot of needs here, especially for the non-motorized users. And so DOT, the Municipality of Anchorage, and AMATS have been sitting down to develop an action plan and how to move forward to help address the non-motorized serious injuries and fatalities in our area. Next slide, please. That's all I had. Thank you.
Senator Schauer has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things for you. One's a comment, but relevant. The other one's more of a question to you. I know, like the bike pass, you had a bike pass subcommittee, and I know there was. I'm not trying to say it's from being a Matsu senator. You're like, why do I care? But because I have a lot of constituents driving Anchorage, and they were not very happy about watching one of the three lanes taken for bike pass when there was hardly any bikes on it, but a whole lot of traffic and congestion. The reason I say that is as the MPOs look at these things and they have subcommittees and they push up proposals, that can call into question just how useful they are or what is the mission if it's going to potentially back up traffic. So it's not a comment at you directly. I would say is maybe as the MPOs are looking at these things, working with the public on bike pass, there's a lot of things to consider, which gives us questions for people back home in the Matsu, which I know the other MPOs are listening because that's where they see these things and wonder, is that going to happen to us? My question more directly to you, and it really is maybe for the other MPOs, and I'll ask the Matsu, the MVA, but when I know the administration is changing, we have a lot of EPA rules, decarbonization, other things that are taking place. It seems to be unraveling a little bit with the new administration. I'm wondering if you've heard any of that, if you guys are considering it, because obviously it seems like things are changing a bit, and that may change the dynamics on how we plan, how much it costs us, because that does drive cost up when you're looking at some of those things. So has that come to the MPO at all? Is that something you guys have started to address or hear about it? And I ask Mr. Trimmer because that's going to affect the MATSU as well. Thank you.
In terms of changes to regulations like EPA or NEPA or anything like that, we haven't been directed of any kind of changes regarding that. One of the big things that we're being made aware of is the potential cost increases to projects through the different tariffs that have been mentioned over the last little while. So if those cost increases do happen, they will be reflected in the project's costs, and we will have to find funding or shift projects around where able. So at this point, I don't want to say we're in a hurry up and wait, but we're kind of in a wait mode to see as more develops nationally.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, I appreciate everyone's presentations today. It certainly was educational as to what happens with MPOs and how they interface with our state Department of Transportation. The Senate Transportation Committee will meet next on Tuesday, March 4th. As there is no further business to come before the Senate Transportation Committee today, we are adjourned at 2:57 p.m.